Buddhist religion. The closest connection is my father actually lived a couple years in a Buddhist monastery and was asked to be a priest in Japan. But he got his name inspired by my grandmother, who lived next close to the Dow Chemical Processing Plant in Indiana. And I tried to act out on their motto, better living through chemistry, and it was quite the opposite for me. Progressively worse living. I am a recovering alcoholic. It's interesting. Many of our speakers have kind of that in common. And I'm also a member of CODA and Al-Anon and several other related programs, including Acronyms Anonymous. And thank goodness there's no recovery from that. I wanted to focus today on being present. That is our theme. We've talked a lot about that in the various presentations this weekend, especially the mind-body soul connection, kind of a holistic approach, how that affects all parts of our lives and our beings. Today, I thought it would be appropriate to talk about what it means in recovery to be present, to be available, to be in the now. That's, I think, really germane to a kind of a closing circle, which I also want us to do. So you have the opportunity to participate and to share what that means, that principle means in your recovery, and how you may have even attempted to do that recently. So this is not going to be a lecture. I'm hoping that this will really be a community experience where we can kind of celebrate. There's much to celebrate in our ACA recovery, of course, including the big book, that I think is a real step forward. And I don't see what's missing in ACA recovery. I see what's possible and our potential and the fact that we're galvanized and that we're the remnant. That was mentioned in a person's address. We are the remnant and the dispensers and ambassadors for the program. And we are the committed many. And we've taken some twists and turns along the way, but ACA is alive and well. It sure is in my recovery, and I want to talk a little bit about that before we do our closing confirmation, affirmation together. You know, it's said in the Scott Peck opening paragraph that life can be difficult. One of our other speakers said that you know, part of our recovery is accepting the sorrow of this life, which is unavoidable. And that's part of becoming present. Rosanna Dana on Saturday Night Live used to say it's always something, you know, and that we move from challenge to challenge, and it's up to us to perceive that as a crisis or an opportunity to grow. In order to really be in the present, I have had to experience a lot of losses along the way that I've had to grieve, a lot of letting go. And my journey has involved some a lot of moods that have been triggered by those losses. One of my most significant losses was my father when I was in my mid-20s. And as I, you know, hinted, he had the same name as I did. So to see my name etched on that gravestone was rather startling to me and a reminder of my own mortality. And it was like I lost a piece of who I was when my father died, because in a lot of ways our lives paralleled each other. And as someone else had mentioned, I was afraid I was becoming him. And he did not die a happy, serene man. There was a lot of angst and commotion in his life. And I was afraid that was going to be my fate. He lost his faith when he was in the ministry, trained to be in the ministry, over a woman. So he had some addiction issues, you know, and that woman became his higher power. And the rest of his life, he was an agnostic. And that really set into motion and activated my alcoholism, I believe. That's what really accelerated it, because I medicated my grief. I wasn't willing to face up to all that meant to me, and how much that went to my core. It was an identity crisis, and I just blotted it out and escaped. And that's when my social drinking became self-medicating and isolating. And I started to isolate in my drinking. Long story short, I got into the other fellowship after a couple years. It took me 2 years to get my first year of sobriety. Many hits and misses, and I finally realized I couldn't borrow from the program. You know, I couldn't go on little vacations from the program and come back without being worse for wear. All these half measures that I took, I was chemically dependent back in those days. It was a euphemism for not, you know, admitting to the disease and taking that first step. I always had to cushion it. Yes, but. Yes, I qualify, but I'm different. You know, and it was a futile attempt at self-management and self-help that eventually caused me to hit bottom, go to AA my first year, go to those 90 meetings in 90 days, then look at my emotional recovery through ACA. Then I was ready to go the full 9 yards and to discover the causes behind my alcoholism. And that was the hard part for me. And it was retreats that, like this, that helped me connect and feel a part of. Through the years, my 18 years, I have been mood challenged. I love these euphemisms. And I've had my bouts of sadness and depression and anxiety. It comes with the territory for most of us. And, you know, they seem to come out of nowhere. But in hindsight, I realized that it was much like St. Augustine's Dark Night of the Soul, that I was going through a time of sacrifice and emptiness in order to be refilled. And that it was therapeutic, that I needed to go through that time where I felt depleted. I don't think I would have kept turning back to the program otherwise. I would have kind of moved on to the next fad, the next what I saw fix. I would have been focused on effect rather than going to the core and trying to realize that, you know, I am powerless. Without a higher power. So I felt like that those years of really acute sadness brought me closer to the fellowship and to myself. And that's a very important part of my story, is being able to admit that. And I remember going to a seminar about 3 years ago, and people were asked how many had experienced a clinical depression within the last 6 months, and more than 80% of the people in the room raised their hands. So we are not alone. This is one of the characteristics of ACA, because of learned helplessness, in part for me anyhow. Nothing I said or did could keep my family together, could change the dysfunctional families, people in my family, and I learned passivity, and I learned to go underneath, to shut down, to go undercover and to run away. And that's what, you know, some of my mood, it was a learned behavior for me that came back up after 7 years of sobriety, pretty relatively smooth sailing the first 7 years. All of a sudden, it wasn't a seventh-year itch. I wasn't tempted to act out. I was acting in. And everything came down on me. I was preparing for the ministry, like my father. I was having trouble with my marriage, and I was feeling a hypocrite and a fraud. I was drinking in order to be inspired in all these theological treatises that I wrote, and there was a real disconnect. I was, you know, in extreme denial over this disease that was taking over my life. And that's when my first grief experience, a sense of real loss, was actually at the wedding. I just remember all of a sudden, after all the, you know, people had left, there was a sense of impending doom and dread. And I said, this doesn't feel right on my wedding night. Something is askew here. One of the other speakers were talking about that. I knew in my gut that I was kind of living a lie and that I would never measure up to who I wanted to be and who I thought others wanted me to be. And that I was kind of hollow in that regard. I said all the right things. I believed everything, but it wasn't put in practice and it wasn't making me feel a part of the universe. I just felt so estranged. And as they say, terminally unique. You know, and it was just always seeing how I was different from everyone else rather than what I had in common. And it really was this paralysis that resulted from that, that caused me to really lose myself and just question everything, including my faith. And I have since kind of managed those moods in a variety of ways, and part of it has been just grieving, understanding in ACA how the past influences the present without attaching blame. Because I think choice does come in, and responsibility. I don't fault my parents. As people say eventually, they did the best they could with what they had. My father had a switchblade given to him by his father, and that's the only thing he remembers being given. There was nothing there. There was no presence. And so compared to the little he received from his father, he gave me all he could. But it wasn't enough. It was important for me to observe that was just one influence. It wasn't necessarily the cause, because it's how I interpreted that and what I did with that and to myself that helped activate my disease and my sense of loss. Part of also with my acknowledging my past is accepting the character that I became, for better and for worse. You know, the eccentricity, the hypersensitivity, the whole package I had to kind of come to terms with, that I couldn't have those defects removed unless I first accepted it as was. That took a long time, and it's still a work in progress. And once I was able to acknowledge my assets and my strengths and my weaknesses and see that those could be strengths as well, then I was willing to have God remove specific defects. And it was real important for me in not attaching blame is to just observe and to kind of detach. And what one speaker was talking about, taking an inventory, a full inventory of how the past is affecting my present, my mind, body, and soul. I really like what Marty had to say about that. And that wasn't just writing down a list. That was therapy for me. That was working with the sponsor. That was working the steps. It is a process. The person Jim said, who was talking about emotions, it is a process that we kind of have to walk through. And that's why later on in the steps, we have that 10th step where we are continually taking inventory and promptly admitting where we were wrong. And that's been a very important part of my taking responsibility, not attaching blame, grieving my loss, allowing healing to take place, not staying stuck in that place, giving my inner child, of course, permission to play and to feel and to let that be okay. I take my inner child to Disneyland all the time, which, you know, people think it's kind of, again, eccentric that I go by myself to Disneyland, but that's, I have a lot of pleasant memories from that. And that is really the happiest place for my inner child, you know, and where I can just kind of let loose and escape in a positive way and let all of that come out, all of the creative child, the playful child. And we talk a lot about inner child. It's one of our, you know, mantles. But at the same time, I also have been developing my inner adult, which has been quite recessed and repressed. And I have to kind of, you know, cultivate taking responsibility, taking action, not just feeling, and being lost in that and marinated in that sometimes. I mean, you know, this is kind of a sensitive area because there is a time to mourn and there is a time, you know, as they say in the ecclesiastes, for everything else. And there is a time to move on and allow, you know, the adult to develop as well, as one of our speakers went through, all those triads. And those are good benchmarks, many of which I can relate to. Forgiving myself and forgiving others. Sometimes I forgive myself by forgiving others. Sometimes I have to forgive myself first. And by the way, if any of you want to interject, feel free to ask questions or make comments. I really want this to be kind of a collective process. So feel free to ask any questions or make comments as we go along. After grieving my loss, as part of being present, putting that kind of behind me as much as possible. And I also want to say, while for me it's important to forgive, it's also important to remember what I've learned from those hurts, from those resentments that have been caused. So I don't repeat. So I don't reenact that again in my next experience with a new relationship, for example. Because if we forgive and forget, then we're kind of destined to recycle. I am anyhow. So I really try to learn and to gain insight. And then one thing that's been really important during these mood shifts that I've encountered over the years, to learn how to tolerate distress and know that there is no quick fixes, there's no escape routes that I can exercise. I don't know how you tolerate distress, but I don't do it very well. You know, I go into hiding sometimes. I engage in avoidance behaviors. And it provides immediate relief when I do that. But I don't learn new coping behaviors whenever I avoid. So it just, I have to come back to reality eventually. And that's where it gets difficult. So kind of knowing that this too shall pass, that I can do some things to take care of myself so it doesn't get the best of me, helps me to tolerate my distress, to practice prayer, you know, having a kind of ongoing conversation with my higher power, not just always vomiting everything, you know, and asking for things from God, but listening to God and God's wisdom and what God might lead me to do. And sometimes it's just waiting. Sometimes it's just allowing God to speak through others. But that's an important part of getting through those hard times that we all have, where we start to kind of lose some hope. And one thing that I've learned as far as my feelings is to kind of feel, to emote, and then, as I said, to take some steps, the next indicated thing, to get into action and not be paralyzed and not be immersed And in order to do that, you know, many of you have been familiar with the process of desensitizing yourself. That doesn't mean discounting your feelings. It just means not allowing it to determine who you are and to take over your life. And that you're more than just your feelings. And feelings are important, but they're not facts. I mean, all those cliches kind of enter in so that I am not bound and gagged by my anxiety. So, you know, that I just am frozen, as someone had said earlier. I'm not frozen in my feeling. There's something I can do about it. And I can detach and I can breathe. And there are a lot of exercises that I would encourage you to look into and when it comes to desensitizing. Focusing is really important and staying in the present and not going through the old script from what happened in the past, exaggerating that, and, you know, just holding on and having that be the sum total of who I am, those past hurts, those broken relationships, the rejection that I have felt from family members. It's so easy for me to focus on that and have that be my continual script for living, what happened to me and how I suffered. And there's a place for suffering, don't get me wrong. You know, I think that's a spiritual journey a lot of us have to go through, and a lot of us really were victims. But there is a time to kind of take some responsibility and know that what I can have some influence over is the present. And that's how I can make a difference and make amends to myself for the damage I feel that was done to me, was to treat others differently and to practice that golden rule and treat myself differently and be my own gentle, nurturing parent. That reparenting comes into play. Any questions or comments so far? Yes. Yes, yes.
And so it's, the irony is, yeah, I'm not in touch with either, you know, part, really. I mean, I'm getting there, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. You know, a lot of us are definitely, I feel undeveloped in that area. Yes,
yeah,
Mary Ellen.
And you touched upon a subject about how everybody, you know, listening to everybody we meet, or and I think one of our speakers, Rob Subby, also talked about how if you're with someone more than 30 seconds, what are you to learn from that person, be it a president or a homeless person? And I believe that too. Every time I meet anybody, you know, a person asking me for a dollar on the street, to whoever, I feel like, you know, God put him in my life or her in my life for a reason. So I do feel like God communicates through to you from others.
Yeah, and not to miss those opportunities.
Not to miss those opportunities.
Yes, Anastasia. Good. Yes.
Hi. You know, one of the things that, as everybody's talking about inner child, and part of my work, a lot of my work is inner child work, but part of the working with the inner child is to learn how to love my inner child, not to allow her to be because she is, but to learn how to reparent my child so that I can be the responsible adult to do those things that we have a hard time doing as reactors.
Absolutely. Any other comments thus far? Yes.
I suggest that you go to whomever is speaking so that your microphone picks it up so there's less dead air time on the recording.
Oh, okay. We can do that. If anyone wants to speak into the mic, they can.
All you have to do is just stand beside.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you for pointing that out. That's important. All right. And I also want to talk about time management a little bit as far as focusing. I went to a time management workshop where I thought would be, they had the big organizers back then where you had your whole life all planned out, you know, and 100 different categories, and I was expecting more of that. And this is a psychologist who just found that she had pancreatic cancer. And she was just talking about being in the moment and not obsessing with how much you accomplish every day. It was quite opposite from what I expected. Sometimes we can be so obsessed with punctuality, so obsessed with getting the most out of every minute of our lives as far as what we perform and what we accomplish, that we aren't able to take in and just live and just trust. And, I try to allow my higher power to manage my time and to lead me some of the time, you know. There's a balancing between responsible and being responsive. Breathing, there was some mention, I think Mario was talking about breathing. There are several techniques, and that really does help me become more aware of what's immediately around me and to just sometimes when I'm wigging out to just do the inhale through the nose, exhale through the mouth 2 or 3 times, and that helps me kind of regain some awareness, so I don't go automatic and go into that panic mode. So breathing is an important part of focusing for me. Meditation, I talked about the 10th sip, good nutrition, all that can fall under the category of outside help. But outside help is inside help as far as I'm concerned, because it's all God's truth that we're practicing, and God works in mysterious ways, and he puts people in our lives, whether they're professionals, whether they're sponsors, to help us stay in balance and to practice what I said is good self-care. Yes?
When you were talking about tolerating distress, you mentioned about conversational prayer. And one of the bullet points you have here is self-soothing and then desensitizing my triggers. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Self-soothing is doing things that reduce your stress level that is kind of contradictory to what you're experiencing. A bubble bath, I think Jim had about 50 different affirming activities you can do for yourself and kind of reassuring yourself that you're going to get through, being nurturing to yourself, but actually doing things that will enable you to do that. Taking those, what they call those mental vacations. From the pressure that you feel that you're under. And it can be very sensory oriented, touching yourself, in a way that's comforting is part of that. Something very tactile. Some people have to grab something, some of those stress balls, that's self-soothing is a very important part of being able to tolerate stress and to get through. As far as desensitizing from triggers, understanding what is a trigger for you, doing that as a part of your inventory and in your therapy, and what your role is to defuse that trigger from causing the same chain of events that leave you feeling crappy. Detachment helps for me. Observing helps. Otherwise, it becomes a runaway situation, and I end up collapsing in a period of sadness, or I have an anxiety attack if I can't. And there's whole books on desensitizing, and some of those are listed at the bottom. But it really isn't. Sometimes there's a difference, I think, between cause and trigger. If you lose a loved one, that is going to cause you to go through a grief cycle. if you know you lose your keys and it ruins your week, that's a trigger. And there are some more notes up on the front if anyone doesn't have my notes. And the one thing I want us to do together today is to celebrate our recovery. I think we fail to do that sometimes, and we are some, you know, it's so easy for me to be so analytical and overwork the steps, not allow the steps to work me, as they say, not allow the steps to nurture me and make me whole, that it's all up to me to do this thing and grind this thing out, and it just becomes another performance. And how many people am I sponsoring? And, you know, how many meetings do I go to a week? And all these standards I set for myself, and I forget this is supposed to be fun. Mm-hmm. You know?
Or,
yes?
Not even necessarily fun, so to speak, as to be, you know, so much in the overexcitement mode, but even so apparent was a failure in some parts of my life to celebrate even success while it was happening. You're so busy becoming successful, you're not taking the time to be grateful that you are successful. And it's the, while things are being good and coming in, and you're not stopping to smell the roses or anything, you're just continuing to grind until it actually almost becomes a recipe for failure.
So easy to get on that fast track. Get compulsive for me. Any other comments? Celebrating involves, of course, a gratitude list that I try to take on a regular basis. And I will say a pet peeve. I hate when people say, and I ask them how they are, it's never been so good. I've never had it so good. I thought, you got to be in some kind of denial. Let's get real, okay? Because sometimes it gets worse before it gets better in recovery. And we have really crappy days. And that's okay. But there is some truth to that, that when I compare and contrast to where I was before recovery to where I am after recovery, as they say, I have quality problems that are manageable through the program. And it's not going to take me down, and I'm not going to lose myself like I did when I was practicing my diseases. Listening is a real important discipline. Richard Foster talks about that in his Celebration of Discipline. You can listen through meditation to God. It's important to, of course, actively listen to each other like we've been doing all weekend. And men, by the way, we're talking about male and female differences. Men tend to interrupt about 3 times more often than females because a lot of us have been conditioned to be poor listeners, because some of us have been conditioned to be such good performers and to have the spotlight on us that we disregard what the person is saying and is thinking about, and a lot of us, male or female, are thinking about, well, what are we going to say next? What are we going to do next? And as Mary said, we lose the opportunity to hear God speaking through that other person and to listen to ourselves and our inner child and our inner adult. That's a very important thing to do as well, so we don't become compulsive and always have to be fixing and improving and reaching these standards that are just unrealistic. Being quiet, knowing, being still and knowing who is your higher power is a part of that for me. Celebrating is playing, dancing, being creative in your expression. I really love what Jim did with the tapes and the music that he brought in. There are music meetings out there. There are crosstalk meetings. Break out of the routine a little bit and take some risks. I think that that's an important part of my recovery, is to not just stick with what's familiar and not be afraid to risk failure and rejection in order to grow. One of my sources of creative expression, as some of you may know, and be braced now, is magic. And it's a way of getting back in touch with my inner child, who just love being the center of attention because I was a middle child and I got almost none. So here everyone was watching me amaze and dazzle. And I returned to that probably about 10 years ago just for fun, just for me. And it's my way of expressing my recovery and making use of my talents that it's just kind of frees me up a little bit. And I think we all have those talents and those gifts that we can practice in and outside of recovery that we just quell because of fear, because what would others think? And a thing for me that's really important is when it comes to recovery, as I said here, is to learn how to link with others. By the way, have any of you seen The Prestige? These are the actual rings used. I'm kidding. And no editing, no editing. But rather than to be whole into ourselves, I've been learning how to be whole with others and to link up and connect. And take those risks of getting to know new people, getting phone numbers at conventions like this, or email addresses, or just get to know people's names, extending my hand, because that is, you know, wherever two or three are gathered, they say in the big book, and in the big, big book, that's where we experience higher power. That's the connect for me. And that's where I discover that I'm not so terminally unique, that I have more and more in common with the other person than I thought I didn't have in common, that I thought that I was opposite from. Contempt before leads to isolation sometimes. And to get to know people on a personal level has been the real substance of my recovery. And what happens in between the meetings, not just during the meetings, you know, those coffee fellowships and connecting with several people. And you know, and before you know it, you end up having a network of people that you can rely on. You know, it might look a little messy and a little confused, but there are several people in your life you call confidants. You have inner circles of support and care and nurturing. And that's a way that I celebrate being in the now. It's, as someone said, taking advantage of all those opportunities. They, you know, call that networking these days. I just call it, you know, being a part of the community and befriending. As we wrap up and lead into more of our sharing and participation time, one thing we don't talk very much about in recovery is the concept of worship, because it seems religious, seems too churchy, and a lot of us, present company included, have some resentments that have been built up over the years about the organized religion. But all worship means is ascribing worth to. Practicing gratitude is ascribing worth to your higher power and how your higher power has delivered on, you know, the promises in your recovery. That's very important for me, to have that feeling of kind of worship within the fellowship. And it doesn't have to be in a church. Just people who bring higher power into their sharing and acknowledge that, you know, the higher power is the foundation and the defense against practicing those old diseases. And what restores us to sanity. So, you know, I'd like you to think about how you could bring a sense of worship into your life, whether it's devotions, meditations, reading daily affirmations, or whether it's in a group of people like a closing circle. That can really be a powerful experience. And they have had music, and they have, like I said, music meetings. There's been dancing meetings. There's all kinds of opportunity to tap into this with, if you're not comfortable, going back to church. The big book says some of us do, some of us don't, but we can still experience that sense of worship and spiritual community. And I say there's a point where you can claim your healing and act on it as if. And that's not faking it. Even if you have lingering feelings of hurt and resentment and loss and depression, you can still claim that through feeling that you are healing and God is making you whole. Realizing that, you know, a lot of this healing is provisional and it comes and it goes. And it's in waves and it's not even all the time. When we engage in contrary action, for example. Any other comments? Yes. That's anyone know what Rule 62 is?
Don't take yourself too seriously.
Absolutely. And you know, that applies across the board for me. Not taking life too seriously as I do my recovery. But that gives me some perspective that helps me know that what I feel won't last forever, and it will change and it will get different. If nothing else, guaranteed, when you're in recovery, things will get different. You know, in either direction, but eventually it does lead, I think, to making amends with yourself and making amends with your higher power and having a better connect with the universe if you want to get grandiose and discovering a purpose for yourself.